Two Florida races in this year's election are in the national spotlight. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. The Senate race between Bill Nelson and Rick Scott has already cost tens of millions of dollars, and it could determine a power shift in D.C. Also, the governor's race between Andrew Gillum and Ron DeSantis may give us a sense of what to expect in 2020. We're going to dig into the races. Plus, there's a special immigration panel coming to Wynwood. We're going to talk to two immigration attorneys who'll tell us about the fight to protect those LGBTQ members facing persecution in their home countries and their hopes of finding asylum in the U.S. And is there room for another college football team in South Florida? What does it cost for a small college to even launch a team? We're going to hear from the president of the university. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. We are now less than 2 months away from the November 6th general election, and after that day, we could see some big changes in Florida leadership. Now, one of the biggest races in the country is the Senate race between incumbent Bill Nelson and challenger Rick Scott. Recent polls have both of them in a very tight race. Another race with national implications is the governor's race between Republican Ron DeSantis and Democrat Andrew Gillum. We're joined now by reporter A.G. Gankarski, who often writes for Florida Politics, to get a closer look at these races, barely just 2 months away. A.G., welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks for having me.
All right, let's start with the Senate race. I mean, so much to talk about here. Polls have these two within just a couple of points, considering the margin of error. How has this race played out so far?
Ian, this has been the classic 51-49 looking race that Rick Scott specialized in his entire career. A lot of money on Rick Scott's side. He's outspent Bill Nelson, but he can't seem to get above the margin of error in polls, despite, you know, having spent $30 million on TV. He's got new ads all the time, but, you know, there's really no way for him to shake the paradigm that was set up a few months ago, even before Scott got in the race. I'm interested to see if Scott can move the needle at all, but they seem to be betting on winning the election narrowly.
And let's talk, you talk about polls, okay? I mean, right. Poll reliability. how much do we trust them? I'm laughing, but it's not funny. But I'm laughing because, I mean, we saw that with the Andrew Gillum winning. The polls said he had right. no chance.
I mean, some polls are better than others. I mean, when you're looking at polls, you're looking at trends, you're looking at what's actually happening, where the undecideds are breaking, and so on. I think, you know, going to Gillum's race for a second, you know, we saw toward the end of early voting that movement was toward Gillum, that people were breaking toward Gillum. The undecideds were breaking that way. The Levine voters, the Green voters, they were committing otherwise, you know, to Gillum also. Nobody really anticipated the result being what it was, except for people inside the Gillum campaign. But reporters looking at the polls coming through, you know, knew that Gillum was going to be close in the top two. I don't think people wanted to say that Gillum was going to win, but it was a turnout model. And Gillum turned out unlikely voters in a way that Donald Trump did, you know, on the other side in 2016. Gillum did that in 2018. People who hadn't been energized in primaries before, they came out for Andrew Gillum, and they volunteered, and, you know, that built the momentum that we saw on primary day.
All right. Well, I got to stick with polls because, all right, there was another one, the Florida Atlantic University poll, and this one was interesting and strange to me. It says that there are many people who don't know much about Senator Bill Nelson. The guy's been in office a long time. What do you think is the reason for people not knowing who their senator is?
I've asked Bill Nelson about this. A lot of people move to the state all the time, and those people, Nelson said, are more committed to the political traditions where they came from in a lot of cases. This is true with Democratic voters. With Republican voters, they tend to have moved here for economic reasons in many cases. You know, no personal income tax, less government regulation, and so forth. So, you know, these factors hurt somebody like Bill Nelson, who's been a centrist Democrat, you know, who's known best for not really revolutionizing, but, you know, carrying the left of center 20th century Democratic modality into the 21st century. Is that a winning message this time around? I don't know. But it seems like Nelson flies under the radar because that's part of his strategy.
All right,
in many ways.
Let's look at these two candidates. Again, Governor Rick Scott, what regions, which voters are he strongest with?
And Governor Scott does really well up here in Northeast Florida. I'm in Jacksonville, and we see a lot of Rick Scott up here because this is a good market for him. The more rural markets in the northern part of the state, typically when you get down to the I-4 corridor and south, it's not quite as strong for Rick Scott. He has made inroads with the Puerto Rican voters in Central Florida this time around. We'll see if that holds in the actual election, but that's Rick Scott country. You know, Bill Nelson, he needs to bring out Democratic voters, and increasingly they are concentrated in urban areas, you know, Miami-Dade, Tampa, St. Pete, and so on. And he's got to be able to run up that margin. And it's going to be tough for him in part because, you know, Nelson's already been distancing himself from Andrew Gillum's positions on things like Medicare for All and, you know, real changes to ICE and things like that. These aren't really Bill Nelson's priorities.
That's interesting. I was wondering about that. So Democrats are riding high with Andrew Gillum as the gubernatorial candidate, but Nelson not on board with a lot of these positions. And is he trying to distance himself?
It depends on who he's talking to. I mean, I sound like Rick Scott's campaign here, but, you know, Bill Nelson, if he's talking to an ed board, he's very careful to say, I don't support all of these positions that were not part of the orthodoxy until the post-Trump era. But, you know, if Bill Nelson's on the stump with Andrew Gillum, like he was in Orlando, he's not saying, well, I don't agree with all this guy's saying. And then he's actually, you know, playing the party line. So it's a balancing act for somebody like him. And it's going to be one he's going to have to maintain through November at least.
And then on the other hand, you have Rick Scott. And, I mean, he's played himself as the supporter of President Trump. But we haven't seen that much on the campaign. I mean, what role does Trump play in this race?
Rick Scott really values that relationship with Donald Trump. However, it's not politically convenient for swing voters. So if you ask Rick Scott about Donald Trump, you're not going to get a direct answer. If you ask him about the latest gaffe from Donald Trump, he's not really going to address that. You know, what he will do is he'll play up the relationship with the White House, like he did with the offshore drilling issue he tried to message earlier this year, where the Interior Secretary said Florida was off the table. That remains to be seen, but that was an example of Rick Scott and the White House working well together. But, you know, most of those conversations are not happening in the public view. So, I mean, Rick Scott and Donald Trump both know how politics work. They both know when it's time to actually embrace and when it's time to get a little distance. And, you know, I think down the stretch, except for maybe fundraising, Rick Scott is going to message solo.
What voter block is going to be the biggest factor in this race, the Senate race?
The Senate race, it's going to be interesting to see if there are undervotes on the Democratic side. Because Gillum's play is toward bringing out the Democratic base, expanding that Democratic base for first-time voters, and appealing to NPA voters. Does Bill Nelson have the same cachet? That remains to be seen. Bill Nelson has moved on certain issues, like he moved on medical marijuana, drawing contrast between himself and Rick Scott on the issue of smokable medical marijuana. Rick Scott doesn't like it. Bill Nelson says that it should be allowed. You know, however,
what about,
you know,
what,
Bill Nelson.
What about the Hispanic race? And you know, because you mentioned a little while ago too that the Puerto Rican bloc. I mean, you're talking about this is a group of people. You have a lot of Puerto Ricans who came to the mainland after Hurricane Maria, and both of these candidates have really put a lot into trying to reach this base and visiting Puerto Rico especially.
Yeah, that's the thing. I mean, Rick Scott's put in more of the work on that than Bill Nelson has. I mean, that's the reason that, you know, Rick Scott's even competitive with Puerto Rican voters right now. They come to Florida, and, you know, politics is different here. It's not quite the same. The party structure isn't the same. The issues aren't the same. So they're up for grabs in a way that I don't know if Democrats fully realize until late in the game. With recent Latin American arrivals, again, I think Rick Scott sees opportunity there. The Cuban-American bloc in South Florida, that is something that Rick Scott has cultivated. Ron DeSantis will cultivate also. So that remains to be seen, but I think the Puerto Rican vote, the Republicans are counting on being competitive there.
I'm talking with A.G. Gankarski with FloridaPolitics.com. We're talking about the race for U.S. Senate between incumbent Bill Nelson and Governor Rick Scott. Right now, almost neck and neck. Also, you can find links to Mr. Gankarski's stories on our website, WLRN.org. All right, let's talk about the governor's race. Andrew Gillum against Ron DeSantis. How do you describe this race?
This race is another close one. Right now we're seeing polling that's showing Gillum slightly ahead. The Florida Chamber, which is typically Republican-friendly, sees Gillum 4 points up right now, leading in every media market but Jacksonville. And the question is going to be, can Gillum hold that momentum? The Republican Governors Association spending $10 million on ads for Ron DeSantis. You're going to see more outside groups messaging for DeSantis against Gillum. So, you know, trying to maintain that that image of being above the fray that Gillum has had up until now, can he do it, you know, through the election? That's really the issue. But right now, Gillum's in strong position. Nobody predicted that a few weeks ago. Nobody expected Andrew Gillum to be 4 points up in the Republican nominee. But politics in Florida, it changes very quickly.
And I think that poll that you were mentioning, too, has a 5-point margin of error. And yes, as you said, we still got almost 2 months. This right. is a race where the president may play a huge role because he's put his support behind DeSantis very early on. How much will this race come down to either an endorsement of the president or a rejection of him?
Well, you know, Ron DeSantis wouldn't be where he is now if it weren't for Donald Trump. So Ron DeSantis can't really move away from Donald Trump. However, by resigning his congressional seat this week, he no longer has to be in D.C. and the Fox News green room defending whatever Trump administration scandal is on the news this week. There's a lot of them, and DeSantis has carried president's water for 2 years, and it's worked out well up till now, but it's not going to work with swing voters in the state. Andrew Gillum's going to keep reminding voters that Ron DeSantis and Donald Trump are one and the same. That's going to be the argument. On issue after issue, if Ron DeSantis defines his position, you're going to hear about Donald Trump's position on the same issue. And it's going to hurt in a lot of ways because, you know, Donald Trump, he polls around 45-47%, depending on the poll in the state. But you have to wonder, there's got to be a certain amount of fatigue with Trump supporters that there aren't with opponents. For 2 years, they've heard Donald Trump's voice. This is a chance to reject Donald Trump, and a lot of people might just do that.
And, you know, these two candidates, by the way, they're not going towards the middle. These two they're pushing off onto the edges. And so I'm wondering, will this tactic work in targeting the fringe voters? Will that be successful, or are both these candidates missing the centrist voters?
Well, I think DeSantis is going to move toward the center of his environmental plan that he released today. He's against offshore drilling and fracking. I mean, these are plays to the soccer mom voter. And over time, these might work. But, you know, this is sort of a different election for Democrats. For 20 years, Democrats have run variations of the same theme. Somebody from the Tampa area who's moderate, who, you know, business could work with if they got elected. Andrew Gillum's not part of that mold. Andrew Gillum is part of the George Soros, Tom Steyer, you know, sort of unapologetic redistributive mold. And it provides a different challenge. For Republicans, ironically, because there are a lot of people in the state that Democrats had not talked to for decades. Younger voters, people disenfranchised, people who feel locked out of things like homeownership and upward mobility. I mean, there are a lot of voters like that out here. And Andrew Gillum is the first guy for a long time to figure out how to talk to them. And I think there are a lot of swing voters and a lot of unlikely voters in that category. And I don't think Ron DeSantis has an answer for that unless he can make the negatives work for him. And, you know, Republicans have a history of doing that. Can DeSantis do it? We'll see.
Let's briefly go over this part here. They both have their lieutenant governor picks. DeSantis went with Representative Jeanette Nunez. Why?
Well, a lot of that was, you know, some of that was Marco Rubio. Marco Rubio and DeSantis talked it over, and, you know, Rubio gave her his endorsement. That's a big deal. But a lot of it's a play for Miami-Dade. I mean, it's a place that DeSantis did well in the primary, but, you know, Andrew Gillum did really well in South Florida, surprising everybody. So there were some of those calculations there. And on the Democratic side, Andrew Gillum picked Chris King, you know, Winter Park businessman. He finished fifth in the Democratic side of the governor's race. And, you know, they look like a ticket. You know, they're both guys who are under 40. They're married. They're happily branding their marriages. They're both left of center.
But should Gillum have gone with a female candidate? You pointed out a few possibilities in your last story.
Right. And Gwen Graham is the great what if. Why didn't Gillum figure out a way to extend an olive branch to Gwen Graham? That would have been the unity ticket. It drew from different constituencies. And I think it came down to trust, because a lot of the campaign saw Graham adjuncts and people who are associated with the campaign saying, well, you don't want to give money to Andrew Gillum because he's got his FBI issue. You don't want to endorse Andrew Gillum and so on. So there was a lot of Andrew Gillum ran this campaign without a lot of Democratic support. And a lot of that was because, you know, Gwen Graham's operatives were very quietly but firmly saying, you don't want to get mixed up with this. And I think that poisoned the well.
Let's finish up with this. What do you think is really the big issue or two issues that the people of Florida really care about in this in the gubernatorial race?
I think in the governor's race, I mean, a lot of this is about the image of the state, what the state wants to be going forward. And it hasn't really been the case so much in previous races. I mean, Andrew Gillum represents the future in a lot of ways, you know, in terms of things like cannabis legalization, the criminal justice system, all of that. Andrew Gillum would be an interesting check toward the conservative influences in Tallahassee. Ron DeSantis, he's straight off central casting. He's like Richard Nixon 1952 or something like that. You know, he's got his Navy background. He's got a beautiful wife. He's a rock-ribbed conservative. Is that going to play in the Florida of 2018? We're increasingly diverse. We're increasingly cynical about, flagpin conservatism of the sort that Ron DeSantis has. So it's going to be interesting to see if Ron DeSantis can, you know, sort of stop the march toward an inevitable, you know, progressive movement in the state.
Midterm elections, usually not that interesting, but 2018 may prove to be a very different year. A.G. Konkarski again writes with FloridaPolitics.com. You can find some of his stories on our website, WLRN.org. A.G., I really appreciate it, man. Thanks so much.
Hey, thank you. Anytime.
All right, still to come, you'd think about immigrants looking, refugees looking for asylum in the United States. How much more challenging is it if you're a member of the LGBTQ community? That's coming up next on Sundial here on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, the number of people deported for living in the United States illegally increased significantly last year relative to the 2016 year under harsh immigration policies adopted by the Trump administration. The ICE director, Thomas Homan, said in a press conference last year, quote, if you're in this country illegally, we're looking for you and we're going to look to apprehend you. Immigration courts can already be difficult for those seeking asylum in the United States. Cases become even more challenging for LGBTQ immigrants escaping persecution for their gender identity or sexual preference. This Saturday, O Cinema Wynwood is hosting a panel about immigration issues with a focus on how they impact the LGBTQ community. First, they're screening a documentary web series titled Finding Home about LGBTQ asylum seekers in Los Angeles. Here's a clip from the trailer.
The United States is safe in comparison to my country because I can be in the bus and no one is going to hit me or something like that. I was raped by police in El Salvador and also by gangsters. I don't have other choice. I am a refugee.
Well, taking part in the immigration panel and joining us in studio now are two immigration attorneys that specialize in these cases. Patricia Hernandez is a founding partner of the immigration and family law firm Rotella and Hernandez. Patricia, pleasure to have you here.
Thank you for having me.
Also joining us is Rebecca Sanchez-Roig, the managing partner of Sanchez-Roig Law. Prior to running for her firm, Roig was a federal prosecutor for Homeland Security and Immigration Court for 17 years. Again, Rebecca, I really appreciate the time.
Thank you for having me.
Let's start with this. I want to get a sense of the level of persecution that some of these people are facing in their home countries. I mean, we think about the challenges they face here, but really multiplied. Worse in some places. Patricia, let me start with you. You have some powerful stories about clients from Jamaica.
Yes, I've represented several clients from Jamaica. In Jamaica, the government has laws in the books that discriminate against gay individuals in particular.
The homosexuality is illegal.
Right. It is. They don't come out and say that it's illegal, but they have a statute in the books that condemns what they call unnatural offenses. And under the unnatural offenses, they have sexual intercourse between two people of the same gender. And they have, additionally to not only the laws, but society in Jamaica also, there's a lot of dance hall artists who openly, in their lyrics, say that it's okay to commit physical violence against people who are LGBTQ.
What's the worst story that you've heard?
The worst story that I heard was someone who was who came out to his family. After coming out to his family, was shunned, was told that, you know, chances are you have HIV/AIDS. You can no longer eat with the same spoons in our house. You can't eat out of the same bowls that we eat. You have to have everything separate. Do not speak to me. Do not talk to me. And this drove this individual to spend a lot more time out of the home. He basically would just come home to sleep because his family wouldn't speak to him. And because of that, he became a victim of rape in the streets. And he wasn't able to go to the authorities because if he went to the authorities, he would be arrested because he had committed a crime.
How would these individuals seeking asylum, how would they go about doing it? I mean, what case do they need to make to the federal government that would be different from any other refugee?
Well, what makes a difference is that they actually would have to talk about their sexuality, talk about how they knew about their sexuality, how they felt, when they knew, if they were open about it or if they weren't. So that's something that in a lot of other asylum cases, you don't have to talk about your sexuality. I mean, you're being persecuted for other reasons. So it becomes very difficult for them to have to open up and be so vulnerable about their sexualities and their feelings.
Yeah, Rebecca, when it comes to, again, refugees seeking asylum, what do they have to say and not say? And I'm wondering, with folks in this community, the LGBTQ community, how much are they willing to say about the reasons?
Well, it's a much more personal case when you're dealing with somebody's sexuality. So in the cases where I've represented asylum seekers and from countries such as Mexico, Honduras, and other Central American countries, they talk about the experiences that they've had since their youth, since their younger days. Most of my clients have known since they were very young that they were gay. And they talk about all of the experiences where they were discriminated, traumatized, pelted with rocks. And then they have to talk about their experiences, and including, for example, one client who was regularly traumatized by the police in his country, where he was raped by the police in his country, police officers. I mean, it becomes a very personal story. And it's often very difficult and definitely painful for them to describe to individuals in an immigration court proceeding or an asylum.
So you see, when you tend to hear the stories from people and they're saying, look, I'm in danger. There's a great risk of harm to me, to my family, if I stay home. And a lot of the times those stories are about drug gangs and so forth. But do you hear a lot of these cases? Is this typical? Or, I mean, and I'm wondering how, I guess, our system handles that. I mean, it's still somebody's life could be in danger, right?
So, yes, their lives are in danger because they're gay. And even for example, when there are laws that allegedly are supposed to protect them, cases are not investigated. Cases against homosexuals in many countries, in particular those that I deal with in Central American countries, are not investigated. So our client could have been raped by an officer, but that case isn't going to be investigated. And certainly is no prosecution, protection.
There's no paperwork. There's no trail, right? Because you don't even want to say anything because,
indeed,
it's against the law.
Indeed, they don't say anything because they're afraid they fear for their lives.
Patricia, you've worked with a number of transgender clients. Tell me about the nuances necessary as an attorney to build trust with your clients. I mean, from understanding the right gender pronouns to approaching certain topics with sensitivity. I mean, you've been at this for a while now, but I mean, what's that process been like for you?
So it's also been an education for myself in learning the pronouns and being able to conduct just, you know, a lot of asylum work is being able to obtain the trust of your client. And in one of those things with transgender folks is calling them by their proper pronouns, you know, just starting the consultation with how, you know, what pronouns would you like me to use? Let's talk about how you learned, that you learned from a very learned age. And just getting a lot of background. Usually with my transgender clients, I tend to have multiple interviews with them, just to even build trust, to even start getting the story, because a lot of times they're afraid to come forward because of what has happened in their countries, because it's not tolerated in their countries. And we have to teach them to say, it's going to be okay. The asylum process is confidential here. You know, we're going to have to talk about these tough issues, but it's going to be okay. You're going to be protected.
I think about the conversations we're having in this country where we're discussing and understanding how we identify ourselves, how we identify, and then helping each other understand, you know, again, how you identify me or any other person. But in these other countries, I mean, that's not even a conversation, right?
Right, yeah. There's not a conversation. They usually get lumped up into, you know, you're just gay, or this is unnatural, and those conversations aren't even had. Nobody ever calls them, you know, a transgender individual, for example, a transgender male would still, in their home country, as a form of disrespect, be referred to under their female name, and situations like that.
Rebecca, you've worked on both sides of this debate as a federal prosecutor for 2 decades and now representing immigrant cases here in Miami. What evidence is the U.S. government or a judge seeking when they're looking to grant immigrant asylum?
Well, you need to be able to prove that you've met the statutory requirement, which is persecution on account of one of the 5 categories. And in this case, it could be a particular social group. It could also be based on race, ethnicity, gender, when you're dealing with a transgender. And you know, asylum cases are very private cases. And so when you're fleeing a country, you don't necessarily flee with a suitcase of documents in your hand, because you're actually fleeing for your life. My asylum clients, some of them will provide me with immensely detailed affidavits. I actually look for country condition reports that talk about gender and identity and gender issues and discrimination in their countries. I always use experts that have sort of boots on the ground that can tell me about the country, about how LGBTQ individuals are treated or not treated in their country. The number of deaths associated with being, for example, transgender in the country. And we build an entire package together based on their activities.
That's interesting. You said, again, yes, a lot of people do not come with paperwork. They do not come with evidence. And I'm wondering about, you know, how do they get the corroborating evidence?
Okay, so when they're in the United States, they often still have family and friends back home. So we ask their family and friends if they were ever hospitalized on account of some of the mistreatment, to see if they can secure records. Many of my clients have actually been members of Rainbow Coalitions sort of secret members of Rainbow Coalitions in their countries. And so they get affidavits from these individuals that are thereafter sent to us. We try to obtain as many documents as we can. Often, there are very few documents, and the case is going to be built on the activities of our client. And for example, demonstrations they might have participated in, activities that they took part in, what they did for the gay movement or...
Because they have to prove, one, that they're part of the LGBTQ community, and then prove that they've been persecuted,
yes,
which is very difficult to do.
Indeed.
How often do immigrants, and I want to hear from both of you on this, have the proper representation when they go into asylum court?
Not always. I don't know what the percentage is, but the success of an asylum case really does rise or fall very often on whether you're well represented or not represented at all.
I guess I'd imagine, look, I mean, it's naivete here, but it's anytime you go into court for anything, if you have representation, you have a better chance.
You do. You absolutely do, especially in today's immigration climate.
And Patricia, I mean, I wanted your take on that too. And do they even know? Like a lot of immigrants who come here, do they even know what rights they have?
Right. So a lot of them don't know. And a lot of them don't know that within the first year that you come to the U.S., you need to file your asylum application if that's what you're going to do. I had a very young client who came here to the U.S. And it wasn't until he came to me literally 2 weeks before his 1 year of being here in the U.S. And it wasn't because he had met a friend who has said, you know, if all these things happen to you, you can probably seek asylum. And he basically said, what is that? How do I go about doing that? And so he came to the U.S. and didn't even know that this is something that he could apply for because he was so young. So I had to rush within 2 weeks to try to get that asylum application and meet with him and try to get his statement. So a lot of times, unfortunately, or they don't have the means or they don't have the information and they miss that 1 year filing deadline. And that creates a lot of additional hardships for them because now they wouldn't be seeking asylum.
I'm talking with Patricia Hernandez and Rebecca Sanchez-Roig, both immigration attorneys here in Miami. Hernandez and Sanchez-Roig are taking part in the State of Immigration panel at O Cinema in Wynwood on Saturday. The panel comes after the screening of the documentary web series Finding Home about LGBTQ asylum seekers in Los Angeles. And again, we're talking about legal issues for the LGBTQ immigrant community. Rebecca, was that... Rebecca, let me ask you this, because a few years ago, you represented an undocumented Mexican immigrant who was arrested for illegally crossing the border into the U.S., and you were able to win the case that granted him asylum under interesting circumstances.
Actually, I'm still representing him. What we won in federal court was a dismissal of an indictment that the government had leveled against him for a reentry after deportation. We were successful after several days in trial in proving that he was denied his constitutional rights by the Border Patrol and the Border Patrol agent who refused to have him see a judge when he kept telling them that he didn't want to go back to Mexico because he was persecuted on account of his homosexuality. So the asylum case is still pending in that case, and there is federal court litigation that's going on now.
You went from prosecuting deportation cases from the government's perspective to now defending them. Why?
Because I wanted to be on the right side of history, and because I also always saw, while I worked with the government, how often individuals didn't have representation or didn't have good representation, and I felt that I could actually make a difference.
How long did that take?
How long did it take to realize that?
Yeah.
It took a long time to realize that. It took years to realize that. But with the passage of time, I just got to a point in my practice that I felt that I needed to do something else, something to actually help out. I'm an immigrant myself, and I wanted to be able to help out. And having the institutional knowledge, I think, is very helpful because it allows me to think as the government officer or official or prosecutor is going to think, but simultaneously take the skills and apply them to the defense.
I'm wondering, what steps do you think U.S. immigration courts should take to make the system more equitable for asylum seekers, or at least level the playing field?
Oh, I think they need to start thinking about becoming Article III courts instead of this quasi-judicial administrative proceeding, which is neither administrative nor judicial in nature. Certainly the judges need to have independence. The judges are not independent of the attorney general because they're essentially employees of the attorney general. So they're independent. And while these judges really worked very hard at trying to maintain their independence, they're under often instructions from their chain of command, the attorney general, as to how cases need to be heard, processed, and how quickly they need to get through them.
And you were a prosecuting attorney prior to Attorney General Jeff Sessions coming into office and, of course, the Trump administration's hardline stance on immigration. What major changes have we seen for asylum seekers under the Trump administration relative to when you were working there?
So I worked for three different administrations, the Clinton administration, the Bush administration, and the Obama administration. And I think that they all attempted and did abide by the law. I think that the Trump administration at this point is finding every way that they can to deny the rights of asylum seekers, and indeed not just asylum seekers, but to curtail legal immigration in the process likewise. So they have taken every possible measure and draconian steps to to prevent and thwart individuals from coming to the United States.
But tell us what was happening under the Obama administration, because there were a lot more deportations going on early in his administration.
Indeed. We used to, in the government, refer to President Obama as the deporter in chief. But they were deported under the law, with due process of law, and in furtherance of the law. And that was the same case with President Bush and President Clinton. Here, I think that I've actually questioned the methodology and the tactics used to remove individuals from the United States. And I think the government is sorely misunderstands that when people are abused and injured and discriminated in their country, they're not necessarily going to care as to what's going to happen when they cross the border. They're going to try to get here anyway. Sometimes, as I heard somebody say in federal court one day, an immigrant say, well, you know, if I spend the next 20 years in prison and at federal detention center, it's much better than my life in Haiti. So, you know, you really need to consider how we're addressing this from a humanitarian point of view also, because they're coming from extreme circumstances.
Yeah, and understanding the motivations people have. You know what, I'm curious, and really from both of you, Patricia, I'll start with you, is, I mean, cost is always a major factor for many immigrants attempting to achieve that asylum, but how often are you working with your clients pro bono or required to offer some kind of discounted price for legal services? And what do immigrants understand about how legal services and legal costs work in the United States?
It's funny that you mentioned that, because Rebecca and I was just having a conversation where I tell her sometimes I have clients who come in for a consultation, and I sit there and I talk to them, particularly sometimes even young children who came here as unaccompanied children. And as I'm talking to them and I'm getting their story, in my mind, I'm having this conversation of, how can I ever ask this child for one dime for my services? I can't, because I know if I tell him a number, he's going to probably try to find a job to get that money. So a lot of times I find myself, you know, walking into my business partner and saying, we have another pro bono case, because I just can't in my heart really charge them. Other times, if I see that maybe they're here with a parent or there's a family member who's an adult, I'll say, okay, I'm going to do it at a discounted rate, at least just cover the cost of the court proceeding or the applications that we must submit.
And it was interesting what Rebecca said earlier too, is that, I mean, look, you give yourself a better chance if you have representation. I wonder how many times do you run into people who they're like, I just can't, so I'm going to have to do this. I'm going to have to go it alone. And what do you tell them?
Right. So a lot of times, you know, there are people who just say, I just can't afford anything. What I try to tell them is, I'll try to say, okay, call me before you're going to submit something, or I'm, you know, try to do as much on your own and then bring me what you have. And I'll try to help you with as much as I can on my time. And really, because here in South Florida also, we have a huge problem with like notarial fraud, people who pretend to be attorneys. And a lot of times our clients become victims of them, and they end up putting our clients sometimes in worse positions that they would if they would have had competent representation. So I try as much as I can to help them along the way as much as possible.
And Rebecca, we'll finish up. Really, the same question to you is when you run into someone like that, and they don't know how the system works here, and you know maybe they don't understand the cost and they don't understand what they have to do next. I mean, how do you even begin to explain that process to them, which is already complicated for us and we live here?
Yeah, I mean, everything is on a case by case basis, and I have quite a number of pro bono cases. But for example, in the case that we just discussed with the Mexican gentleman, after I read several thousand pages in a Freedom of Information Act return of documents, I knew that I could help them, but I knew they'd never be able to pay me. So you explain to them, you're going to do this pro bono, and this is going to take years. Other cases, if they're cases that I knew they know they need representation, but they aren't able to do so, I refer them out to organizations in the community that might be able to help them.
And these are questions that will come up, I'm sure, again this weekend. Patricia Hernandez and Rebecca Sanchez-Roig, both immigration attorneys in Miami, and they're going to be part of the State of Immigration panel at O Cinema in Wynwood this Saturday. We'll have more information on our website coming up later today at WLRN.org. Patricia, Rebecca, thank you so much.
Thank you for having us.
All right, still to come, is there room for another football program in South Florida? Well, another university is going to start one. That's coming up next here on Sundial on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, before we get to the rest of the program, I want to tell you again about this exciting new signature segment we're launching here on Sundial. Sundial's live from the 305. It's going to be a bi-monthly conversation about music performances with artists that make South Florida this culturally rich place. You're going to hear jazz, hip-hop, folk, plus stories about touring around the world to making a name for yourself online. And we're going to have music videos of the performances on our website and, of course, on social media. That's coming up starting tomorrow, so stay tuned. You know, in states like Texas and California, high schools are starting to drop their football programs. This according to a USA Today report, but not in Florida. In Florida, it's actually growing. And that's what the folks at St. Thomas University, a private Catholic college in South Florida, well, they're banking on that for success. Earlier this month, the school's president, David Armstrong, announced that the school will field a new football program and a marching band next fall. And he believes there's a lot of talent to choose from, and there's plenty of room for another college football program. So we spoke to him recently, and we asked about a football team and what it means for a school that small.
Football and athletics is a great enrollment driver on a small college campus that's tuition-driven. And so St. Thomas University is a smaller university, smaller college, and in order for us to live our mission, we have to have a margin. And enrollment is how we do that. 90% of our budget is in enrollment. I worked for and learned under some wonderful mentors over the years who taught me how to use athletics as an enrollment driver. So that's the first thing. That's the main reason. Now, people will say, oh, football's expensive. Well, that's because they're doing it a different way. There's two ways to build it. You can either build it and hope that they come. That's very expensive and it's very risky. The way I learn from my mentors is we have a dream, we sell that dream to students, the students buy into that dream, and then we fund the initial phases of the program through operations, through tuition revenue. And that has worked out very well for us. I was at an institution that went from 300 students to 1,334 full-time students, headcount of just under 800 to 2,700. And we went from 8 sports to 24 sports. And so you can fund these things through the operations. So that's a key point at a school that is, again, tuition-driven, is to be able to run it through operations. Lastly, I'll say this. It brings instant community spirit. Football, marching band, all those sounds of fall are kind of college sounds in the fall. And so we will bring an immediate, we have a great spirit here at St. Thomas University. This is going to only enhance it. Miami is the mecca of football. Every college program in the country, no matter what the level, scholarship, non-scholarship, all recruits this area.
So my understanding, President Armstrong, is that it would have taken a couple of years to get this going, but you announced that this team is going to start playing next year. That seems like a quick turnaround. How is that possible?
So actually, this is a long turnaround for me, what I'm used to. The last time I started the football program, we made the decision in November and hired a coach on March 1 and started the football season that year. And so this is actually more time. I feel like I have all the time in the world compared to what I'm used to. That's a joke. Here's why the timing is right, is that we had an opportunity because of some connections that I had, and because of the work of St. Thomas University and our athletic director, Laura Courtley Todd, and the reputation we had in the Sun Conference and in the NAIA, there was an opportunity in the what's called the Mid-South Football Conference, which the Sun Conference is a part of, this year, because my previous institution where I was president, Thomas Moore, is leaving NCAA Division III to go back to the NAIA. So that created an opportunity in scheduling for another team. Four teams applied for the position, and they awarded it to us. because of my relationships and because of our reputation here at St. Thomas University. So in the end, in order to start football, it's not about the money first. It's about conference affiliation and schedule. If you have a schedule, you can start football. If you don't have a schedule, you can't start football. And so the fact that that opportunity came to us is very providential. I won't say lucky. We're a Catholic school. Providential. And so we took the opportunity to do it. We had football as part of our blueprint for leadership, the previous strategic plan, slated to start eventually, probably in 2021. But when that schedule and conference affiliation situation came up, we had to take that opportunity.
My understanding, too, is that you want to start a marching band. Now, do you want a marching band to go along with a football program? Or, I mean, in some schools, marching band sometimes is even bigger and more popular than the football team. But what do you envision for that marching band?
Absolutely. So I actually have hired Ken Carr, who worked with me at Thomas More College and built as the assistant director of our bands, helped build that band, and also was the director of choirs and built a choir. So the marching band is approaching 200. Our choir is over 100. Both started with zero. And so, and Ken knows how to do it. My goal for a marching band is to march in the Macy's Day Parade someday. And in order to do that, you have to have 250 members. So that's what we're shooting for. But band takes a little bit longer than football. We'll probably start out anywhere from 30 to 40 year one. And then we will grow that by that number every year. Some years you have better years than others, but I think that we can be up to over 100 very soon, very quickly. Football, on the other hand, and we will actually start recruiting for marching band by midterm. So we hope to get at least 10 members in before at the midterm time so we can practice in the spring. But I think knowing Ken, we'll be able to get more than that. And here's how you do it with band. Again, that goes back to that last point I made with the growing enrollment is financially leveraging. We actually offer scholarships for band. And those students who have worked in band their whole life and they're dedicated and their parents that are dedicated, we want to reward that by giving them band scholarships. And so that's how you do that. You leverage your aid in order to get the students interested in the band. Football, we hope to bring in about 20, if not more, at midterm time. And then we hope to have in year one a roster of 100. In the future, we want to carry a roster of 200 because, and we will have a quality JV program giving students an opportunity to play. But that's what makes it economically feasible is by having quality roster size.
You're listening to a previous interview that we did with St. Thomas University President David Armstrong. They recently announced that they're going to launch a new football team. It's going to be an NAIA team. And also, along with that, a new marching band. And all of this will start next fall. Some people will remember that the Miami Dolphins used to practice at St. Thomas. Where's this team going to play? How long do you think it'll be before you have really your own stadium facilities?
You know, that's another reason why we wanted to bring football back to St. Thomas University. There's such a great history with the Miami Dolphins here. And from 1970 to 1992, you know, the undefeated Dolphins practiced here. There's a great affinity there. And it showed when we did our reveal how many alumni Miami Dolphins came back. It was just fantastic. And I found something out. Larry Little, you know, the great offensive lineman, I got to get in a stance with him on the stage, and I was like a kid at Christmas because I'm an offensive line guy. But I didn't know that we gave him an honorary doctorate in 1977, so I have to call him Dr. Little. Coach Shula, who's also a native of the Cleveland area, Northeastern Ohio, like me, they did such great things for this campus and for the area. We think we honor them by starting football back here at St. Thomas University. As far as where we play, we do have a lot of space here on campus, but we also are looking to create a partnership with Monsignor Pace High School, which is also an archdiocesan entity, and they're on the same plot of land that we are. And we think that we can bring our efforts together to synergistically improve our opportunities for facilities. And not only us, those two schools, but also create a facility that the youth of Miami Gardens and all of South Florida can use for soccer and football and all those other things. So we're looking at, again, a big vision and a big plan to not just take care of our university and our high school, our Archdiocesan High School, but to take care of the community as a whole.
So, President Armstrong, what do you envision for this team over the next few years? I mean, it's hard to get a program started. You know, you might get some wins in the first year or two, but it's going to take a little bit of time to build that talent up. What do you see in the next 3, 4, 5 years?
I'll take you right to it. I see a homecoming with 5,000 fans and a marching band of over 150 and a football team of 200. And we're not only winning, we are recognized on a national level for the quality of our football programs. Again, Miami is a mecca of football. We're going to be good right away because of the talent in this area and the talent of coaching in this area. And so we're gonna light it up here on this campus on a Saturday in the fall. It's going to be packed and exciting and creating a wonderful student experience for all our students here at St. Thomas University. Because in the end, education is not only the mind. It's the mind, body, and spirit. And as a faith-based institution, we believe in those, in nurturing and nourishing those three things of the human spirit.
David Armstrong, president at St. Thomas University. A little slip of the tongue earlier said private Catholic college. It's a university. So their football program starts in the fall. I wish them the best. Thanks again for listening. I'm Luis Hernandez. Talk to you tomorrow.